So this is the third week that I've been here. I usually don't come on Thursdays anymore. I used to teach on Thursdays a lot, especially when we were in Palo Alto. So it was very nice to be back here. And next week someone else will come. And I'm prepared to venture forth with kind of a talk, give a talk on. But I thought it might be more interesting and perhaps more useful to take the time and see if there's any, start off with questions. Sometimes we have wonderful discussions just rising out of people's questions. And sometimes in these settings we spend a lot of time talking. The person up here talks a lot. And I think it's quite valuable to have more of an exchange and to hear what your concerns are about meditation practice or Buddhist practice or things that are related, and to see where that goes, that kind of discussion. So, is there anything on your minds? Anything that you'd like to ask or that seems related to this kind of practice or what we do here? I might say that there's a little tradition in Buddhism that you create very good karma for yourself if you ask questions.
I don't know if this is just way too basic, but it just occurred to me that I don't think I really understand what's meant by enlightenment.
So what's too basic? It's too basic, elementary question. That's like the So the question is, what is enlightenment? And the word enlightenment perhaps is an unfortunate translation of the words. The word in Pali, the words in Pali that are somewhat equivalent, or are the word bodhi, which is the word Buddha, and it means it can mean having wisdom, having understanding. Some people say it means to wake up, to be awake. But someone who's like a university professor is said to be like a bodhi, to have a lot of bodhi. So it's, I mean, nowadays at least. No. But generally in the West, it's translated to mean to be awake with a capital A. Someone who has understanding. Someone who's cut through it's the opposite of being lost in ignorance. So being awake is kind of the opposite of ignorance, or having understanding. The other word that's used is vimutti. And vimutti means to be freed, to become free. Another word that's used is the word, you know, the word nirvana. In our tradition, the same word is nibbana. And nirvana, that can be argued, literally means something like to unbind. In other words, kind of to release. So this idea of becoming free, becoming released, becoming awake. Are more literal translations of the original. And we use the word enlightenment because it was a word that existed in English, and it had a lot to do with 150, 40 years ago in England. The English translators were struggling in the context of the Christian Catholic Church, Protestant Church in England, and dealing with issues of the Romantic movement and the Enlightened movement and religion, and so they kind of all enlightenment, you know, because it kind of they were using Buddhism in England back in those days as a counter to the religious traditions of England at the time. There are a lot of associations with light that comes with to be awake in Buddhism, to become free. So maybe that works well. Some people kind of pun on the word, and it means to be enlightened is to become lighter, not just with light in terms of sunlight, but lighter in terms of weight, you know. And that's a nice kind of pun because some Buddhists get so heavy, you know, so dour, you know, so serious, and then, you know, enlightenment is supposed to make you lighter. So it's considered to be the ultimate aim of Buddhism, in a sense, to become enlightened, to become awake, become freed. And in the early, and also then you have in different Buddhist traditions, you have different understandings of what it means. So, you know, you have to kind of a little bit look at the different traditions and understand their own context. And there's this, we're going to do this scholarly class here in a few weeks, on a Saturday the 26th, I think, where there's going to be a scholar, a Buddhist professor, who's going to talk about the different worldviews that Buddhism existed in India, China, and Japan. Because how they understand enlightenment has a lot to do with the worldview of that culture and how what they think is the ultimate. And just like here in America, probably the same thing will happen here. What we think is the enlightenment is, you know, will probably be shaped a little bit, at least how we describe it, by our own conventions here in the West. One of the things you see here in the West is a lot of the Western teachers put a lot of emphasis on the experience of interconnectedness. And they, it's so strong, this emphasis, that you get a sense that the ultimate purpose of Buddhism is to get a sense of our interconnected selves, how interconnected we are. And it's a lovely, kind of almost a borders, or is a kind of, can be a mystical experience to feel the unity of all life and feel, you know, intimately connected with everything. And it's an experience which is marvelous. And perhaps from the point of view of early Buddhism, Indian Buddhism, that experience of interconnectedness would be understood as being the pinnacle, the ultimate experience, just short of liberation. The ultimate experience you can have within the conditioned world, within the world where you're still not really free. But here in the West, we emphasize interconnectedness so much, and you find out, if you look just beyond Buddhism in the West, you find in Christianity and Judaism and all over, American spirituality, in the last, I don't know how many decades, a tremendous emphasis on the spirituality of interconnectedness. It's not just a Buddhist thing. It's really a Western current. And the Western teachers are really riding that current and often talking about it as if it's a Buddhist thing. And it's a healthy thing, it's a wise thing, but it's an example of how our own kind of worldview may be influencing how we understand what enlightenment is. In the early Buddhist tradition, and to some degree still to this day in places like Burma and Thailand, the experience of awakening is primarily defined not by an experience that you have. It can be described that way. But it's mostly described by how you're changed. So, and particularly what you're freed of. So it becomes a description of what's missing, what's absent from you after you've gone through this transition. And again, here in the West, there tends to be a lot of emphasis on having a spiritual experience as validating your enlightenment. If I really feel the oneness of life, I really see great light, or you know, if I disappear and have experience of no self, you know, then that, you know, that experience, and people are kind of looking for an experience to validate their life, their spiritual life. And experiences can be important in Buddhism, but the point of the experience is not, they're not ultimate aims themselves, but they're stepping stones to having the kind of deep trust or deep faith or deep insight that allows a person to let go of the last remnants of clinging that they have in their minds or their hearts. So it tends to be release from things like clinging, release from, and then, you know, there's a whole bunch of things. And it sounds kind of negative because these are all things you don't necessarily want. But the release from clinging is the most common definition. Nirvana is the complete release from all clinging. And if it doesn't take a lot of insight, a lot of self-reflection, to realize, especially if you want to meditate for some time, to realize how much your mind is not free. You sit down and you try to close, you know, you try to focus on your breath, and you can do it, you know, five breaths, and your mind goes off, and you come back 5 minutes later, and you try to kind of hold your mind steady and have some control over your mind, and you realize you're not free, because, you know, mind has a mind of its own, and we get, you know, we get lost in our, so we have obsessions, and we're carried away by our obsessions. The addiction in Buddhism is not an addiction to drugs or alcohol, but you know, the mind is addicted to its thoughts and its ideas and its feelings. So to begin realizing, you know, that the tenacity of clinging in its subtlest kind of core forms is one of the things we tend to discover through meditation. And at the same time, meditation is one of the paths to help us free ourselves from that clinging. Sometimes enlightenment is described in terms like freedom, to be free. But in the West, that's a little bit complicated because in the West, in American discourse, American kind of thing, there's a strong emphasis on freedom to do. Freedom, you know, the right to vote, the right to shop, the right to bear arms. you know, the right to our own property, the right to do things. And this is a kind of very strong, as I understand, very strong current of American society, and it's, part of it's quite beautiful. The emphasis in Buddhism is not the freedom to, but rather it's freedom from. And because a person can be free to, to shop, and so they say, you know, you go into this wonderful like Stanford Shopping Center, and you're given a, you know, credit cards, you know, that you can unlimited usage, and you could have just, some people, I wouldn't, but some people would just have a blast, you know, going shopping. They're free to buy whatever they want. But what happens in that kind of freedom is that your desires to have is, you meet no obstacles. And it's just filled with joy, but to have. And there's no obstacles to having, so you don't feel any suffering. But as soon as you have an obstacle in your desire, then you feel the frustration of not getting what you want. But if you get what you want too easily, in terms of something like shopping or, you know, whatever, then you might not notice that your mind is actually not free, but you're actually being driven. There's a compulsion to have that is pushing you. And so if you're limited in some way, then you might notice through your frustration that how the compulsions are operating. You're up against your compulsions. Now, some people on that point will blame someone else. You blame society, you know, Stanford Shopping Center because things aren't cheaper or whatever. And what Buddhism says is that at that point, when you feel frustrated because your desires are not being fulfilled, there is an opportunity there to notice the ways in which your mind is not free. It's not that Buddhism is problematizing desire. It's saying that the desire which is driving you is a problem. And so to no longer be driven by your desires, but rather to have a wise relationship with your desires and to pick them and choose them as you wish, means to be free. And so the focus on Buddhism is not freedom to, but rather freedom from. So there's freedom from clinging of various kinds. There's freedom from hate, freedom from aversion, freedom from fear, freedom from attachment to a sense of self. And that's considered one of the more core ones, this attachment to self-image and self-representation and ideas of who we are. Because many of us make ourselves safe and orient ourselves to the world by having some image of who we are. And so we say certain things to people in order to get them to validate or support our image. We don't say things to protect it. They'll think bad of us if I say that. Or we hide parts of ourselves, or we present parts of ourselves. Or, you know, there's all kinds of things, you know, or things happen to us and they threaten our idea of who we are, our sense of self. And so it's very core, the idea we have about who we are. And it's fine to be someone. But what Buddhism suggests is that if you really want to be free, you can't be attached to being anyone. And so that freedom from attachment then becomes, you know. So the tendency in Buddhism is to understand this thing, enlightenment, as classically is defined by the absence of something. And now that's not very satisfying, because you say you've attained the most wonderful, you know, ultimate goal of Buddhist practice, and your friends say, you know, what did you get out of it? And, you know, show me what you got out of it. You know, you can't show them anything particularly, you know, in terms of, you know, that you got something. However, it probably makes you a kind of, you know, much happier and radiant and light and, you know, calmer person, not to be driven by a mind of greed, hate, and delusion. So is that a satisfying answer? It's a long one. You want to ask more, or why do you ask the question? I was told once, when people ask that kind of question, you shouldn't answer them at first. You should first ask them, why are you asking that question? And then they'll say, oh, it's because, you know, my partner just left me, and I was wondering what Buddhism has to offer and helping me with my grief. And, oh, in that case, let's talk about that. But anyway.
I was actually just thinking, because I sat in the beginning meditation, just and it's just focusing, the idea of focusing on the breath with then this idea of enlightenment. And I don't mean enlightenment dismissively, but focusing on the breath now. And then, yeah, I was just...
So good. I should have asked you that from the beginning. See, I'm slow to learn from my teachers. I always ask them what they... back up a little bit. So there are different notions in Buddhism of what enlightenment or awakening is. And some people hold the different notions of awakening in conflict to each other. Say, well, this is what it means. No, this is what it means. But some of them can be held together. So, for example, one common conflict is the one between, is awakening something you attain down the road? You know, you're going to huff and puff and follow your breath, and you know, what's your connection with breathing and huffing and puffing for? And how many breaths do I have to follow after all? You know, I'm okay to do it if it's 100, but if it's 1,000, I'm out of here. You know what's so this idea is something down the road, and actually full awakening in Buddhism is generally considered something that you have to put a lot of diligent effort to reach. It's not something you kind of, you know, meditate that week at home for, you know, half an hour for a week. So that's one notion. It's something that's down the line, some very clear, definitive, kind of an experience, transition, a turning point in the person. Another whole idea is that awakening is not something that down the line, but awakening is something that's inherent in awareness right here and now. And so so it's not a matter of finding and creating and making something down the line, but in a sense it's a matter of relaxing into the awakened state that's already here, or the freedom that's already here. And some people like who are non-dual, anyway. And so in this school, sometimes mindfulness itself is said to be either a kind of an awakening or very closely related to awakening when mindfulness is pure. A moment of mindfulness is a moment when there's no going for or against what you're experiencing, no desire, no aversion, no fear. There's kind of a radical openness and acceptance of this very moment, this now, right now. So it's this present moment, this timeless now, it's this experience right now, met with kind of this uncomplicated awareness. So both are possible. So the question is, what's the relationship with mindfulness of breathing, with awakening of both types? In the first type, where it takes a long time, mindfulness of breathing is a foundation upon which we're training our mind. And so we're developing the mind's ability to be concentrated, to be mindful of what's happening in the present. We're training the mind to learn to be in the present moment by being in the present with the breath. The breath, for many people, is one of the preeminent objects for centering the mind, quieting the mind, calming the mind, strengthening the mind, clarifying the mind. And so a person would be with the breath in order to get those kinds of develop that kind of thing. A lot of people find a lot of benefit from staying with the breath long before they get, you know, enlightened in the, you know, in that kind of view. And so just simply some people find benefit just in one single sit of sitting, the first sitting. They're calming down, relaxing a little bit, and just being a little bit more relaxed can help us see the whole world in a new way. It's so easy to be caught up in all our thoughts and fantasies and everything, and just to be with the breath can clear the air. So for some people, quite nicely, quite beautifully. And the more skilled we get at doing meditation on the breath, the quicker you'll find your ability to kind of clear the air, to clear the mind, and empty the mind in a sense of all the things that get in the way, the filters from seeing things more clearly. And then as we develop the concentration, then deeper insights occur, and we develop the level of concentration necessary for some radical transformative experience. Other people will emphasize that the point of following the breath is not to get anywhere, but rather it's to wake up to that very breath right now. And the idea is you're trying to get someplace beyond this moment. It gets in the way of really being fully present for this precious experience right now. And there's no other point to be with the breath than just to be with the breath. And if you can really do that in a full way, it's deeply, deeply satisfying. But then that becomes a whole training to get to that point for some people. You know, it takes a while to get to that. But the point is not to get someplace beyond the breath, but really just be with this breath. And again, it doesn't take a lot of reflection to realize how poorly we can just be with the breath. I mean, say that you can be with, say that you finally your mind's no longer wandering away and carrying you away, but you actually stay with the breath. But then we don't relate to the breath, something like the breath, in a free way. We might be judging it. Oh, this breath isn't so, this is not a good breath, you know. Here in California, you're supposed to have a long, deep breath. And, you know, mine was really shallow, you know. And then I'm not really doing it right, and maybe I should move to. Be careful what I say. But, you know, move someplace where, you know, where I fit in better. Because they breathe, you know, different like me there. And so the mind goes off, you know. So you're looking at the breath, but it's getting complicated by all these interpretations and meaning we put to on the breath. Or say the breath is a little bit uncomfortable. And say, oh, I don't like that breath. And you're kind of trying to push it away or change it or be angry at it or something. Or say we have the most pleasant breath. And then you say, oh, I'm going to hold on to that. And, you know, that's great. Let me, how did I breathe just then? What was that? Let me see if I can do it just the right same way. Maybe that little ripple at the end of the out-breath. That was it. Can I do it again? No, I missed it. And then you try for the next 2 years to get that little... And I've known people who've tried for a year at a time to re-experience some beautiful, blissful experience in meditation. And they're trying to kind of... And the very attempt to try to get it sometimes just makes it impossible for it to happen. So even being with the breath can be complicated. And so the task is, how can you really be with the breath, just this next breath, and not complicated with any for, against, or interpretations, or ideas, and just the breath itself. Even something as subtle as being bored with the breath means that there's some distance and some filter between you and the breath. And if you're really with the breath with no filters, it's as if the breath is the most interesting thing in the world. It's so wonderful and satisfying. Now, these two views of what you know, the awakened state can be like can be reconciled in various ways, but a simple way is that you can't actually follow the pathway where you could develop concentration and mindfulness over time unless you give up any idea of trying to get to a goal in the moment of doing the practice. In the moment of doing the practice, both approaches have to look the same. And since they both have to look the same, Even the path that says that awakening happens right now, if you can do that, as a byproduct, you're also going to be developing your concentration, your insight, and all these wonderful things that the person on the long path is taking. So it doesn't really matter which one you understand, as long as you do either way diligently. That makes sense? Kind of? Does that help? Are you inspired now to follow your breath? Yes.
I've been trying to do a lot of cleanup this week, and I find I have a very hard time letting go of memorabilia kind of things, photos or anything sentimental or things the kids did in school, even though, you know, that's a form of attachment, but that's a really hard one for me to deal with because it's sentimental.
So why do you want to get rid of them?
Why what?
Why do you want to get rid of these things?
I guess I'm just overwhelmed by too much stuff that I've held on to.
Yeah. Well, sometimes we have to suffer enough to let go. So when you're overwhelmed enough, you'll let go, even though it's painful.
Okay, so being attached to stuff like that per se is not a bad thing. I mean,
In Buddhism, usually we don't try to judge things as being bad.
I realize that. But rather, the goal is to not be attached.
Right. I would suggest a little bit different wording. Mm-hmm. If the goal is not to torment yourself.
Okay.
And
so if I have room for it.
Yeah, but if you're attached to it, it might be the source of future torment.
I see.
If your house burns down, uh-huh. Then that it's like the shopping thing, right? If you have unfettered shopping, mm-hmm. You're happy. But as soon as you're... So the same thing, any kind of attachment which, where the attachment is not being threatened.
I see.
You know, we won't notice that the causes and conditions are there, or the conditions are there for us to suffer. Mm-hmm. So some people will take that into account and practice really diligently to free themselves of their attachments mm-hmm. before the attachments cause them to suffer.
I see.
And some people wait until they suffer and then they try to work with it. Now, you know, it's very touching, your question, because I mean, it sounds like you feel a need to let go of certain things, and it's hard to let go of them. You're probably going to do it anyway, but you suffer as you do it because of how you feel. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, you certainly need to be very respectful and appreciative mm-hmm. of those memories. It's beautiful to have memories and associations. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's very nice to do a little ritual around that. Maybe to gather all the things together and do a little ritual and say thank you to them, or thank you to the memories, or say to the memories, you know, these memories and the connections are really important for me, important who I am, and I'm letting these things go, but it doesn't diminish the value of what happened in the past to me. So sometimes a ritual can help. Sometimes sitting and meditating in the middle of doing that kind of chore can help. You sit down to meditate. You say you're beginning to clear out all the stuff, and you start feeling the pain or the sentimental attachment.
Right.
And then you sit down and meditate for 20 minutes. And sit with it. And what you might discover that as you sit and get quiet with it, you might discover different depths within you. That pain is a door too. And it might be actually quite beautiful what you discover. And you might find as you go into this beauty, what's deeper, that you find also that there's less need to keep the things. So is that okay? Are you smart?
Hmm?
Are you smart?
Not all the time. and it's getting easier to discover the times that I'm not. But that does seem to be sort of a self-validating kind of clinging, like even if I discover that I was wrong, oh, well, I'm smarter now. And so I'm still able to establish that as an identity.
Well, that's fascinating. This is a kind of a side, but there was a study I read in the paper some years ago where they measured how people self-evaluated themselves according to their intelligence and their competency. And so I think what they did was they gave people an exam. And then they asked people to... to self-evaluate how well they did on the exam before they saw the results, kind of. And then they compared, and they compared the actual results from the exam with how people self-evaluated themselves. And the tendency was that those people who scored very high on the exam did really well. They tended to self-evaluate themselves very lowly. They weren't so smart. They didn't do so well. And those people who scored really low on the exam, they tended to overvalue themselves, that they really did well. So the interpretation or the speculation among the researchers was that people who are smart will know what's missing. Will know, you know, will be obvious to them what they don't know, and so they feel inadequate. But people who are not very smart, they won't know what they're missing out on. They just know what they know. So I don't know if this helps you. But that particular one is I don't have an image of myself being particularly smart, but the image of being smart or not smart has been one that's caused me some suffering. And to me, I trace it to its genesis in part to my father, who was very smart. And he's a, you know, a great physicist and great mind. And so there was kind of a comparison with my father that kind of left me feeling a little bit kind of inadequate. And that sense of inadequacy then fed into or was a fuel for my kind of preoccupation with, am I smart enough, am I not smart, you know, and all that. So that was kind of where the source of that grabbing onto. Sometimes it can be useful to look back in your life a little bit and see, was there a point or a place where that started? And sometimes by seeing that, it's a lot easier to become free of, you know, an attachment to self-image like that. You smile knowingly. And so that's, you know, kind of a therapeutic technique. Another way is to, more the practice way, is to continue as you're being now, being very honest about it, both to yourself and to others, and sit and meditate and be very, very, very attentive to how this thing works. Notice the subtlest forms in which it arises, and really stop and pay attention to the idea of self-image and self-image as being smart or whatever, and really make that a theme that you're going to stay with and stay with every time it rears its head. And sometimes it's helpful to elicit other people's help. You know, tell your friends it's happening again. You know, and or they'll nudge you. I think it's happening again. You know, and by staying present for something like that and seeing it, sometimes you can begin discerning where the choice resides. There is choice of whether to cling or not to cling, and then you can begin relaxing the clinging. Is that enough?
I think so.
Okay, I can go.
I think it's good work the other way too. If you don't think you're very smart, like you said, you know, yourself, you can, if you can consistently think that, you could have done better. I could have done this, and I could have been that, I could have done this, could have done that, but you know, I didn't, so here I am. I see that as a problem in some people.
Now, it's very interesting, I don't know how many of you know this, but I talk about it often enough. There are three forms of conceit in Buddhism. There's the conceit which we think of as conceit, when you think that you're better than someone. But there's another kind of conceit, is the conceit that you're inferior to someone, lesser than someone. So those are two kinds of conceit. The third kind of conceit is to think of yourself as equal to someone. So then the question is, what's left? What do you think?
Not comparing.
Not playing the game.
Judgment.
What? Not playing the game, you know? Not needing to be anything compared to others, just who you are. What?
Or you're not separate from the other person.
Or you're not separate. That can also help. Can you imagine living your life without playing that game of comparisons?
It's hard to imagine. Because I already talked to you earlier about some of the problems in the school system and how that entire game is drilled in our culture here at early age. It's like almost all about that. And I reflected on how, and they were talking like they were really upset, like this is a new thing. And I was thinking, you know, when I was, that's how it was when I grew up too. And that's, I think, been the case. And it's something that there was suffering that took some time to get over. And I think when I did learn to meditate, that helped. That was a big jump.
But then not just school system, but also families and society, and you know, we have these young children at home, and when my first child was you know, I don't know how old, 1.5, 2, or 2.5, and could understand language, my wife insisted that we not say good boy to him, but rather say good job. Because say good boy, and you're making a statement about who he is as a self, kind of self-image kind of thing, and then he has to live up to being a good boy, and that it's a setup to fall, right? Because then you cannot be a good boy. But if it's a good job, it's, you know, it's a little bit, you know, it's easier maybe for the psyche, or you don't even say that. Maybe you say, oh, that was fun, or you must have had lots of feedback. Boy, you must have had lots of fun doing that. You know, they just want some contact and some, you know, feel like they're seen. You don't have to make some interpretation of who they are. Wow, you had a lot of fun, didn't you? And then the energy is there, the delight is there, but we're not kind of helping them create a sense of self. Some years ago, I was visiting some friends, and they had a daughter who then, I think, was maybe 3 years old, or maybe a little bit younger, she was beginning to speak a little bit, understand words, and so I pointed to different people in the room. So who's that? And she said, oh, my mommy. Who's that? My daddy. And Who's that? Tamara. Who's this? Gil. And then I pointed to her. Who's that? And she said, I am. So I said, who are you? And she said, I am. And since I'm kind of slow, you know, you'd think I'd know better. But I kind of, a third time I said, well, who are you? And she got up kind of indignant and said, I am. She didn't need to be anybody. She was just, amness was enough. And then I remembered that that's what God said to Moses. And, you know, so I... So it's, we start very young with this thing, you know, creating an idea of who the kids are and who we are and living up to it. And went on retreat some years ago, this man came and said that something he carried with him as a real burden all his life. He was in his 50s when I met him. When he was small, his mother would say to him regularly, you're a really nice guy, but not so sharp. Over and over again, that's what he heard. So he had this image that he wasn't somehow, you know, he wasn't sharp. And it turns out exactly he was quite sharp, but somehow, you know, he took on that as a burden, as an image that really caused him a lot of suffering. So we should be careful what we... So we say to our son, you know, good job or whatever. And probably when he turns, you know, 25, he'll come back and complain and say, you never validated me. You know, you probably can't do it right. That's why we have Buddhism. So there's hope for the kids. Yes.
I have a question about holding anger. My girlfriend is going through a phase of her life when a lot of things are going wrong, and she's very angry. And she usually holds that in a way of, this is not okay. What happened is unacceptable, and that feels hard for me to hear from this kind of Buddhist perspective of, well, it's okay, everything is okay. And I'm wondering if you have any ideas as far as how to be supportive of that anger and those feelings without validating or whatever.
So the question is, so your girlfriend has a lot of anger, she blames the world, angry at the world, things aren't going the way she thinks it should go. And then your question is, how do you relate to her, how do you support her, how do you work with that? And also, the Buddhist idea of that everything's okay means, how are you? How should you be with her? Should you just accept her anger because everything's okay? That's a good question. And I think it's a little bit unfortunate that many of us teachers, like myself, put a lot of emphasis on this idea of acceptance. Because it gives the sense that we're supposed to, everything's okay, that we're supposed to let everything just be as they are, not judge anything, everything, you know, whatever happens, fine. The idea of acceptance is not a condoning or accepting injustice or things that are wrong so much. It has to do with how we hold it in our hearts or in our minds. It means that we're not going to let the minds become contracted around it, or the heart closed because of it. So the acceptance is an acceptance into awareness without our inner life doing something that's painful to it, before or against it, in a sense, tight against it. We might still wisely decide, this is not appropriate, this I won't stand by. So I've had people get angry with me, and sometimes, because of my practice, I've just been an open channel to it. I had one person who got angry with me on a retreat, and... she was berating me and yelling at me, and I was sitting like this, listening to her, and I was very attentive, very respectful, nodding. And I got very interested to know, how long a person can talk without me saying anything. And it lasted for an hour. And, you know, I just let it come through me. That particular time, there were no hooks in me. And next day, she was very grateful. She thanked me because she never had the experience of someone who had not been afraid of her anger. And I wasn't afraid of it, so I just took it on. I mean, I didn't take it on. I just kind of just was there for it. And that's sometimes been useful. Other times I found it useful when people have been angry with me, to not contract, not to resist the experience, but to say, no, you know, this is not right. And if you continue being angry this way, then I'm going to go away until you can come back and be calmer, or, you know, I kind of say, put on a limit and say that, you know, very, very, very accepting of the person. I say, you know, I like you and all that, but this behavior is not acceptable. So there are, I guess.
Well, that's what I'm trying to figure out is, her anger isn't directed towards me. It's directed towards the outside world. And I don't feel like it's useful to say I'm not able to hold this, but that is what I would say, is I'm not able, I'm just filled up, I can't take anymore. The rapture has been going on for an hour or so.
Yeah. So, if I may, what you might try doing is some point when she's not angry, you know, and things are really going well and well enough, and you can have a conversation about these things. You can tell her, look, you're struggling with something, you say, and you'd like to help with the struggle, and you need some help because the problem is that when she's angry, you'd like to be present for her and help her and be supportive, but there's psychically a limit in how much you can hold, and you're getting to the point where you're going to break or some, you know, you're getting sick or something. And so can you guys, two of you together, brainstorm a little bit how you can both be supportive and take care of yourself so you don't get sick? And if you ask her at the right time, you know, maybe then she'll say, oh, I didn't know. Or, oh, okay, in that case, you know, let's put, you know, she might come up with some idea, or together you come up with some idea. And maybe it can be that I've known couples who've had some kind of a prearranged agreement when they're yelling at each other, that one of them raises their hand. That means that they take a 5-minute pause. And the 5-minute pause can make a big difference. But to ask for a 5-minute pause in the heat of the battle, you know, it's, you know, you know, it's like suddenly you get whopped more. So, you know, that's one thing in terms of taking care of yourself. And if she's not willing to help take care of you, then it's a problem, because then how can she expect you to take care of her? And so she has to be, there has to be some kind of movement back and forth of taking care of each other in this kind of circumstance. And the last thing I wanted to say about people's anger is that in a very careful way, in a very respectful way, if you can try to tune in to what's below the anger, if the person is afraid, or if the person feels really hurt or threatened. And if you can say something that somehow you know, talk or relate to that part of them that's afraid. And you have to do it very carefully, because it can seem, you know, like condescending, or it can be like you're the therapist suddenly or something. But, you know, it could be, for example, a very simple thing I remember from a friend of mine who was at the beach one day, and the parking lot was full, but there was an empty parking slot, and I think he pulled into this parking slot without seeing that someone else had been waiting for it. And so the person jumped out of his car and was yelling at him and, you know, berating him, and, you know, and before he could kind of back out and do anything, you know. And so my friend, at some point when there was a pause in the yelling, said you must be having a hard day today. And the guy just relaxed his shoulder and said, yeah, today's really hard. And that was enough to kind of break the ice and meet his people. Now, you have to be very careful with saying even that, because if a person's angry and you say that, I mean, then you'll get it in the nose. So you have to be anger, you have to be, you know, have to be, but there are all kinds of ways, you know, and if you can tune in to what else is going on, It certainly gives you a little bit more options of perhaps how to respond.
Are there any Buddhist practices that address that or anything?
Which part of the anger?
Are the meditations that I would do as far as holding that or anything like that?
Holding your anger or holding the pain of someone else's anger?
On the pain of someone else. Uh-huh.
There's two things you could try doing. One is the pure mindfulness meditation with it, which is just sit down and just open to the pain that you're feeling. And then start noticing what your relationship to the pain is. Are you afraid of your own that kind of pain? Are you angry at the pain? Are you resisting it? Are you, are you assigning meaning to it? This means that, it's just like we talked earlier about being with the breath in a simple, uncomplicated way. Can you come to that uncomplicated, simple way of just being with your pain? And that's actually very healing, because the less complicated relationship you can have with your own emotional pain, the quicker that pain will heal itself. So that's one thing you could do, just do the mindfulness of it. The other thing to do is to do some loving-kindness practice, metta, and which is you can do it toward yourself, or you can do it towards another person you're having difficulty with. And that can sometimes be very helpful to loosen up the places where we're contracted or holding. What you're describing it doesn't sound easy. So, my answers might sound easy, but, it's easy to be a teacher sometimes. Just say a few things. But I respect that, and I'm very glad you're asking the question, because it shows you you're struggling to try to find. And I hope you hang in there. And
So what I mean by that is that I've definitely been around people who aren't very calm, and it's a weird escalation sequence for that person. It's like a separation from someone else. So you actually separate yourself further by being calm. And because it's the idea of really being with someone, there's this thing that when you mimic someone, it makes you feel like you're accepting them. And I've definitely been angry and had some. Get very calm and just
being
so much more angry.
Yeah, well, it's complicated because all the dynamics that are going on. But certainly, some people who have aversion or afraid of anger will take refuge in being calm and kind of disassociate. Sometimes it can be condescending. It's kind of like, I'm so much better than you, and so they get pulled into this calm state. And it's very and then it's really irritating. and they talk in a calm way, and they say, I think you should try to calm down. And it's just, sometimes it is the intentions of the person who's calm are fine. But there's nothing, however, the fact that it's a contrast to how you are, that contrast can highlight the person's own pain. Because if anger is arising out of pain, and they can feel their own pain stronger because it's being highlighted or reflected back on them that way, I can imagine some people might actually, get wind up even more. And then, I don't know what to say then. Yes, Laura.
I was going to ask, maybe as a follow-up, you would talk to this gentleman about things, types of meditation to do in order to kind of embrace someone else's pain. What if you're the person that's just a screaming ninny and really angry? I mean, I can step back and go, okay, I'm going to do some loving-kindness meditation. Pulling yourself out of that, knowing that my head's spinning 360 degrees because of the anger I have about something, watching myself, knowing that this is very unlike.
Well, there's a lot to be said. I mean, one is you have to have some modicum of mindfulness to know that that's what's going on, to have some choice of what to do about it. So that's why developing mindfulness is very helpful. And the more the mindfulness you have, the more control, the more choices you have in the relationship to being angry. One thing I strongly advise people when they're angry is never make a decision when you're angry. If you can avoid it. Wait. And I recently knew someone who was just furious and made this big decision, but they had all the information all wrong and didn't take any time to find out what was going on, just went ballistic. And so don't make a decision when you're angry. What I find useful for myself when I'm angry is I really like going for walks. So I try not to talk to someone when I'm angry. I mean, sometimes I can't help it because the situation requires it or whatever. Right? But I try not if I'm angry, I try not to talk about to the person, but rather pull myself out of the situation for a little while, go for a walk, be with myself. But I don't try to avoid. I'm not trying to run away from the situation. I love walking because I can go and just, walking helps me clarify my thoughts, see what's more clearly what's going on. And I try to be with the anger. And walking is one place where I can contain the anger, the energy of the anger, just with the physical movement. And I stay with the anger, be with it. And until I'm calm enough or clear enough that I can see what else is going on. And I find the most useful is to find out if I'm either afraid or if I feel hurt or threatened. And if I notice that underneath the anger and I'm no longer in the grips of the anger, then I'll go back to the person and start the conversation not from the point of view of, I'm angry at you. Even that might be better than some of the things I might say. But rather I'll go back to the person and say, when you said that to me, I was really hurt. Or I got really afraid. I'm afraid of our relationship, what's going to happen to it or whatever. And I've always find that then the then there's an opening for a conversation. The person then is interested in the conversation. The person doesn't feel threatened because you're saying, this is how it is for me. So and then the conversation tends to be much more useful. But if I come back and threaten someone with my anger, then more often than not, it doesn't really, there's no conversation, there's no open door. So I get out of there. Meditation is also a good thing to do. I mean, sit down and meditate. It's fascinating to do mindfulness while you're angry. And to sit down there, you sit down and commit yourself to not moving, not punching anyone else. But it's like being at the rodeo, and you might sweat. But you feel all this, the amount of energy in the body and how it's coursing through you and the restlessness and the jumpiness and and the beehives of activity. You have to be in awe of it all. And it's really great to just give it its freedom, because a lot of people don't give their anger its freedom. We have judgments or we give it its freedom, but we act on it. But it's very different to give it its freedom and not act on it and sit still and let it kind of course through the body. It's actually cleaner in some ways if you don't act on it, I think. And just let it course through your body and eventually it'll kind of quiet down and calm. And it can bring a lot of confidence to a person to do that a few times and learn that they can have the ability to write it out.
Thanks.
Good luck. Oh, you won't be angry with me, will you, for having left enough time to end with a proper sitting? Let's end with just 2 minute sitting. Just. It's a gift to offer your attention to whatever you're paying attention to. It's a precious gift. Even when you give it to yourself, attention to yourself, it's really a beautiful gift. So it's perhaps no coincidence that we started with enlightenment and ended with anger. Many years ago, I showed up at the San Jose sitting group, and I was going to give a talk about enlightenment. But before I did, I asked, does anyone have any questions first? I announced, this is what I'm going to talk about. But first, before I go into this big topic, does anyone have any questions? And so people had questions, and we spent the rest of the evening talking about anger. People are more interested in anger than they are in enlightenment. Which is kind of nice because it's a more practical, immediate concern for the practice. So, thank you, and it was lovely to have the discussion with you. I hope it was nice for all of you.